The Hidden History of Britain, Part 7. Constantine the Great and St. George. The story of St. George is so intertwined with that of Constantine that no survey of the life and martyrdom of the saint would be complete without a consideration of the active interest taken in the events of his life by this Christian emperor and in the many memorials to him set up after his martyrdom. Constantine's father, Constantius Chlorus, is recorded as one imbued with the principles of justice and toleration. His mother, Helena, daughter of King Cole of Eastern Britain, who has come down to us in nursery rhyme as Old King Cole, was a Christian, well known for her good works. Helena is recorded in the British Chronicles as, quote, "surpassing all the ladies of the country in beauty, as she did others of the time in her skill in music and the liberal arts. Her father had no other issue to succeed him on the throne. For this reason, he was very careful of her education, that she might be better qualified to govern the kingdom. Constantine made her his partner, and by her had a son, Constantine." Helena, born at Colchester, the pious wife of Constantius Chlorus and the mother of Constantine the Great, who was descended from the blood of the British kings. Colchester has from time immemorial borne the cross with the three crowns for its arms. Helena was unquestionably a British princess, states Melanchthon, and Sozomen writes, quote, "It is well known that the great Constantine received his Christian education in Britain." Constantine, writes Polydor Virgil, born in Britain of a British mother, proclaimed emperor in Britain beyond doubt, made his natal soil a participator in his glory. Thus, Constantine, by his mother's side, was the heir and representative of the royal Christian dynasty in Britain. This Constantine should not be confused with Constantine the Tyrant, a British prince who preceded Constantine the Great by about 35 years. The name Constantine was fairly common in those days. The confusion arose in this case, however, by both having a son named Constance. Further confusion is caused by the fact that a British princess, Helen, daughter of Eudaf, king of Western Britain, who married Clemens Maximus, named one of her three sons Constantine. This Helen was about 100 years later than the Helena, daughter of King Cole of Eastern Britain, who married Constantius Chlorus and whose son was Constantine the Great. Quote, "The Emperor Constantius Chlorus was personally favourable to the Christians, but being only the second personage in the empire, he was obliged to conform to some extent to the Emperor Diocletian's commands. Gaul, in which country Constantius resided for a time, escaped persecution through his intervention." Close quote. Constantine himself declared of his father, quote, "The former emperors I have been accustomed to regard as those with whom I could have no sympathy on account of the savage cruelty of their character. Indeed, my father was the only one who uniformly practised the duties of humanity and with admirable piety called for the blessing of God the Father on all his actions." Close quote. Constantine, a Christian through his mother's teaching, was launched at an early age on a military career, and while still a boy was sent, practically as a hostage, to the Eastern court. This course was insisted upon by Diocletian when he raised his father Constantius to the rank of Emperor of the West. Constantine accompanied Diocletian to the East in AD 295. He was invested with the rank of Tribunus Primae Ordinis and served under Galerius on the Danube. Both Constantine and St. George served under Galerius in the Egyptian and Persian campaigns, and between the two young Christian soldiers a lasting friendship was formed. When Eusebius, Bishop of Caesarea, first saw Constantine as a young man on a journey through Palestine before his accession, he was struck by the sturdy health and vigour of his frame. Eusebius frequently refers to it and maintains that it lasted to the end of his life. The return of Constantine to Britain in AD 305 was a direct result of the demand of his father Constantius for the restoration of his son, who continued to be held as hostage. Some authorities say that Constantine only escaped from the Eastern court with his life. Constantine's return to Britain took place immediately after the abdication of Diocletian. His motive in returning was, in fact, to escape from Galerius, who had not yet begun to exhibit any of the toleration towards Christians which marked his later years. In Britain, Constantine remained until after the death of his father in the following year. Constantius Chlorus died in his palace at York in 306 AD. Constantine received the imperial authority in Britain itself, having been proclaimed emperor at York and crowned king of Britain by the voice of the people at Silchester in 306 AD, prior to leaving his native shores to be proclaimed emperor of Rome. Britain's primacy in regard to Christianity could not possibly have been more clearly demonstrated on the page of history than by this son of the British Helena founding his empire and being crowned in Britain and going thence in July 306, supported by native British troops, to conquer and Christianize the Roman Empire and plant the cross of Christ on the throne of the Caesars. The three primitive things of the Cymry: a primitiveness of hereditary possession, a primitiveness of civil society, and a primitiveness of Christianity. And of course here it doesn't mean that it was primitive, it means that they were the first to have a hereditary possession, the first to have a civil society, and the first to take on Christianity. These were the three things that the Cymry boasted of. One of the new emperor's first acts in his position of supreme authority was to grant toleration to the Christians of Britain and throughout the empire. The Edict of Toleration was followed by, in rapid succession, the decree for the observance of Sunday in the towns of the empire, the use of prayers for the army, abolition of punishment by crucifixion, encouragement of the emancipation of slaves, and the prohibition of gladiatorial games. Every one of these steps was again to the Roman Empire and to mankind, and of these benefits none has been altogether lost. Undoubtedly, if Constantine is to be judged by the place which he occupies among the benefactors of mankind, he would rank not among the secondary characters of history, but with the very first. In 314 AD, Constantine convened the Council of Arles, over which he himself presided. Bishops and clergy were summoned from east and west of his vast dominions. This famous council of the early Christian Church was held mainly for the purpose of settling the difference of opinion as to the treatment of the weak and timid Christians who had denied the faith in time of persecution, and also to consider other causes of dissension in the church. Some of the lapsi, who had denied Christ and sacrificed to idols, were afterwards seized with deep penitence, and some even suffered martyrdom. The command to deliver up the scriptures had given rise to another order of apostates. These had had recourse to a subterfuge by surrendering heretical writings instead of the sacred books. The earnest spirit of the age treated them as no better than traitors. According to the Greek Church, it was at this Council of Arles that Constantine proposed that his former companion in arms, the martyred George of Leda, should be chosen as a model and example of the young manhood of Christendom, and was henceforth termed the champion knight of Christendom. The names of the British signatories at this council were Eborius, the Bishop of York, Restitutus, Bishop of London, and Adelphus, Bishop of Caerleon on Usk. Ancient Britain thus set her seal to the adoption of George of Leda as the champion knight of Christendom, to be in later years adopted as her own particular patron saint. Dean Stanley writes of Constantine as, quote, a pillar of the Eastern Church, and continues. Nor is his life without a special connection with the history of our own church. To English students, I cannot forbear recalling that he was, if not our fellow countryman by birth, yet unquestionably proclaimed emperor in the Praetorium at York. The remembrance of that early connection long continued. It shaped itself into the legend of his British birth, of which, within the walls of York, the scene is still shown. His father's tomb was pointed out in York until the suppression of the monasteries. His mother's name, Helena, lives still in the numerous British churches dedicated to her. London Wall was ascribed to Constantine. One argument pleaded by the English ecclesiastics for precedence in the councils of Constance and Bâle was that Constantine had been born an Englishman. He was not only the first Christian emperor, but the first example of the intervention by a sovereign power in the internal affairs of the church. Close quote. After the Council of Arles, the bishops became a regular court party, with free access to Constantine's presence. There was usually a group of churchmen at court whom he consulted, and further, the Edict of Milan changed the Christian Church from an organisation barely tolerated by the state to a legally authorised corporation, recognised as holding corporate property, and the clergy were, by Constantine, exempt from paying tax. And I'll just interject there and say, well, that's very similar to the Druids, who also were exempt from paying tax. It is recorded that the years during which Constantine was giving his direct personal attention to the government of Britain and Gaul were years of prosperity for them. The same may be said for every part of his vast empire. It was entirely due to the influence of this active Christian organiser that the religion began to shine gloriously. In this connection, it should be remembered that no Christian's life was free from the fear of torture and death during the first 3 centuries of the Christian era. The first protector of the church, Constantine, caused the sacred symbol, a figure of the cross, to be emblazoned across the Labarum, which henceforth became the imperial standard of the Roman power. It was committed to a guard of 50 men, whom it was believed to shield from danger in battle. It raised the enthusiasm of the Christian soldiers who had followed Constantine from Britain, Spain, and Gaul. It rallied the oppressed Christians everywhere to his side, and for many centuries in the East, the Red Cross was used as the symbol of Christian against pagan, and later came to be regarded in the West as the personal sign of Saint George. Schaff states that the victory of Constantine over Maxentius and Licinius was a military and political victory of Christianity over heathenism. Within 10 years of the accession of Constantine, the Christian became the prevailing, the established religion of the Roman Empire, and with it came into prominence the Red Cross. The symbol of the cross was in use in pre-Constantine days, though for fear of the reproaches of Jews and heathen, it was not yet in its proper form, but only in a form that indicated what was meant. Namely, it was in the form of a Greek tau. From the suppression of persecution by Constantine, the symbol of the cross was used openly and fearlessly. The Christian spirit pervaded the domestic and civil life, and thus was developed a code of Christian morals, which expressed itself in the family devotions and family communions, and in putting the sign of the cross upon all callings in life. The sign of the cross was made during every ecclesiastical action, and even in private life was frequently used, and so in the East the Red Cross became established as the symbol of the Christian. In the West, the symbol came to be known as the Cross of St. George. England is the only country that has adopted the Red Cross of St. George as its national ensign. The reason for this may perhaps be found in Harding's 15th century chronicle, where a still earlier origin is claimed for our Red Cross device. There he connects it with Joseph of Arimathea. Quote, Joseph converted this king Arviragus by his preaching to know ye laws divine, and baptized him as right hath Nennius, the chronicler in Britain tongue full fine, and to Christ's laws made him incline, and gave him then a shield of silver white, a cross and long end overthwart full perfect. Those arms were used through all Britain for a common sign, each man to know his nation. And these arms, by Joseph's creation, full long before St. George was generate, were worshipped here of muckle elder date. It is said that Constantine, instead of rewarding his soldiers for valour with a plain gold collar, such as was customary, rewarded them with a gold collar of Greek characters, from which was suspended a cross, like that which supernaturally appeared to him, and attached thereto the image of St. George. It is not therefore surprising that the cult of St. George became so rapidly widespread, gaining much in popularity from the connection of St. George with the cross displayed in this spectacular fashion. Nor would Constantine have chosen a more effective form by which to establish the memory of his late comrade in arms, the soldier marcher, in the minds of those to whom he desired the champion knight of Christendom should be, an example in Christian grace, and whose courage he wished them to emulate. On a Greek manuscript in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, the Coptic cross appears in yellow, red, and green. On each side, the foot of the cross is a peacock. To the early Christians, the peacock was emblematic of a glorious body. This bird was adopted as a type of the resurrection on account of the annual renewal of its beautiful plumage. Some historians have said that in 1066, William of Normandy, called the Conqueror, flew the standard of the Red Cross of St. George from the masthead as he approached the British Isles, and under it fought the Battle of Hastings, making it, by his victory, the national flag of England. The Bayeux Tapestry shows a banner with a red cross of equal arms received by William from Bishop Odo and carried by a standard bearer when a camp was entrenched at Hastings. The field of this banner is a pale bluish colour and the cross is in red. The earliest appearance of the crucifix, as distinct from the cross, is fixed by M. Raoul Rochet at the close of the 7th century, almost contemporary with the Council of Constantinople. Constantine not only enjoined on all the subjects of the Roman Empire to observe the Sabbath day as a day of rest, but also to honour the day which preceded the Sabbath. In this, he was conforming to the custom of the Church in keeping the Judean Sabbath as a day of cessation from work, and in addition, the Christian Sabbath as a day for worship. 30 years after the death of Constantine, the Council of Laodicea removed all scruples as to the duty of Christians to keep this Judean Sabbath. Custom, however, prevailed for centuries, and in the British Church both days were observed as late as the time of St. Columba. Constantine rebuilt churches that had been destroyed during the Diocletian persecution, and he gave liberally to charities. By the Edict of Toleration, the Christian churches were to become legally collegia, guilds, corporate bodies with rights and liabilities defined by law. The Christians, however, were remarkably slow to respond with enthusiasm. The Church refused to be a collection of colleges. It planted its standard for freedom of organisation and universality of membership for white nations. The Panegyric on Constantine by Bishop Theodotus contains the following eulogium. He was a lover of God, a lover of charity, a lover of man, a lover of goodness and of every person. He went to church morning and evening every day. He made large assemblies at the Holy Communion. He prayed to God with great earnestness. He gave away large charities and gifts. And he and his house and his mother, the God-loving Queen Helena, feared the Lord always, and they praised and blessed and thanked our Lord and God and Saviour, Jesus Christ, to whom be all glory and honour, now and for ever. Eusebius tells us that Constantine made a practice of systematic benevolence to the neglected poor, as well as those who had fallen into poverty from good stations in life, to widows and orphan girls in particular, whom he provided with dowries. The tabernacle, a tent, made in the shape of a church, which Constantine always carried with him in his military expeditions, is described by Sozomen. Upon the site of the place of execution, where St. George was beheaded, Constantine and his mother Queen Helena erected a church, which at the present time is used for Mohammedan worship, and known as the Mosque of St. George. Upon the site of the shrine, erected over the remains of St. George at Leda, Constantine built his magnificent Byzantine church. Constantine is known to have dedicated 21 churches to the honour of St. George. That at Leda is referred to in the Greek Menology in the following words, quote, "Not long after the death of St. George, religion then beginning to shine gloriously, and Constantine, the pious emperor then reigning, such as was devoted both to the gospel of Christ and the martyr, built at Leda a beautiful and magnificent temple to his honour, translating thither the blessed corpse out of the obscure corner where it had been buried, a temple of so high esteem that the feast of the dedication of it was kept holy, and so continued to succeeding generations." The first church in Jerusalem, dedicated to St. George, is said to have been erected by the Empress Helena near to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre at the time of her sojourn in Jerusalem in AD 326. In the opinion of the archaeologist Dr. Conrad Schick, this tradition is based on truth. In the calendar of the Eastern Church, the Empress Helena and her son are always united. Churches were erected at Helena's instigation and at Constantine's cost. In Britain, a church was erected by Constantine to the memory of Saint Amphibolus, one of the victims of the Diocletian persecution, when 10,000 Christians of Caerleon on Usk alone perished with their teachers. The memory of the Emperor Constantine as the founder of the Church of St. Amphibolus at Winchester was preserved until Commonwealth times by his sword, laid up in the great reliquary of the cathedral. This is the first recorded instance of a sword laid up in a sacred building.
You're listening to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
Constantinople, which was rebuilt by Constantine in AD 330, was built on the site of the ancient Byzantium. It was the first purely Christian city ever built. No pagan temple was open for public worship within its bounds. This city of Constantine was made by its builder the capital of the Roman Empire. Constantine, the first Christian emperor, the first example of the intervention of a sovereign power in the internal affairs of the church, stood in peculiar relations both to the Eastern and Western churches. He retained the office of Pontifex Maximus among his imperial powers in order to possess a legal right to supervise religious questions. Never did he swerve from the policy proclaimed by him in one of his early edicts. Quote, "We call God to witness, the Saviour of all men, that in assuming the government we are influenced solely by these two considerations, the uniting of the empire in one faith, and the restoration of peace to a world rent to pieces by the insanity of religious persecution." Close quote. The extent to which Constantine succeeded in this worthy aim has been the theme of the church and secular historians over many centuries, and to the people of Britain, the leading Christian nation, it should be a matter of importance that this first Christian emperor was British born. Constantine married Fausta, daughter of Maximus Herculius. Fausta cannot have been other than a Christian in view of Constantine's own beliefs and his powerful defence of Christianity. Also, in view of his reference to Eutropia, Fausta's mother, quote, "One benefit, and that of no ordinary importance, has been conferred upon us by my truly pious mother-in-law." Close quote. Constantine, like some even of the noblest characters in the Christian Church, regarded baptism as a complete obliteration and expiation of all former sins, and therefore deferred the ceremony until near the end of his life. Even a century later than his time, such men as Ambrose and Augustine of Hippo were still unbaptized, the one in his 34th, the other in his 32nd year. We may be sure that the practice was sufficiently common in the far more unsettled age of Constantine to awake no scruple in him and to provoke no censure from his ecclesiastical advisers. Constantine was baptized in the Lateran Palace by Sylvester, Bishop of Rome. He gave him the palace which had witnessed the baptism. He gave him the dominion over the city of Rome, over Italy and over the Western Empire. Quote, "Ah, Constantine, to how much ill gave birth, not thy conversion, but that plenteous dower." So, Dante wrote in the bitterness of his heart of what he believed to be the origin of the Pope's temporal sovereignty. This would appear to be of the historical reason that the palace and church of the Lateran, rather than St. Peter's and the Vatican, formed the nucleus of Christian and papal Rome. Here, and not in St. Peter's, have all the Roman councils been held. This, and not St. Peter's, is the cathedral church of Rome. Here, and not the Vatican, was the early residence, and still takes place the enthronization and coronation of the popes. On the throne of the Lateran, and not on the chair of St. Peter's, is written this inscription. "This is that gift, if you the truth will have, which Constantine to good Sylvester gave." Close quote. That Constantine only accepted baptism shortly before his death is well attested by many historical writers. The place of baptism came into the realm of controversy at the end of the 5th century. Eusebius, Bishop of Caesarea, states that Constantine was baptized by Eusebius, Bishop of Nicomedia. The supporters of the Roman claim state that a baptistry was discovered in Rome which bore the name of Constantine. If, however, the place of baptism is disputed, the fact of his baptism has never been questioned. Constantine became ill at Helenopolis and afterwards proceeded to Nicomedia, where he died on Whit Monday, May the 25th, 335 AD. His body was removed from Nicomedia to Constantinople, there and not in Rome, which city, it is said, he visited but twice during his reign. The remains of Constantine the Great were solemnly interred in a church, which he had himself erected as a mausoleum, and called the Church of the Apostles. A sarcophagus called of Constantine still remains in the Museum of the Seraglio.